Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today's episode is a weekly docket where I recap some of the headlines in true crime from this week. Before we get started, I want to tell you guys about Brian Koberger and the complaint that he just made from prison. So I'm not sure how these even came out, but these are like complaint forms that he wrote by hand. He has the handwriting of a kindergartner, first of all. I put these on my social media, so you can go see him on Instagram or Facebook, but he wrote that he's been getting sexually harassed while he's there because other inmates are saying that they want to butt fuck him. Sorry, there's no other way to say that. I know, like, sorry if you have kids around, but that's what they said. And that one of the inmates said the only ass we'll be eating is Koberger's. And honestly, I just love this for him. I think this is only the beginning. And, you know, what a nice appetizer to what he will hopefully expect for the rest of his days in prison is just the constant taunting. I mean, I love that for him. And I honestly can think of no better person who deserves this type of treatment and worse. But he writes, the juxtaposition of his handwriting and the way he talks is very interesting because the handwriting is so scratchy. But he says, as I continue the SPI phase, I wish to discuss if I may be transferred to another AGSEG setting. Same as B block, not engaging in any of the recent flooding. It doesn't even matter. All of his stuff, none of it really makes much sense. But his basic complaint is that he's being sexually harassed by other inmates. So anyway, that is how I chose to start off this week's docket because I just figured you guys would love that. And now without further ado, let's get into the top headlines this week. If you follow me on social media, you know I've been very immersed in the Emmanuel Harrow case. So we're going to start off with that one. So this all started last week on Thursday, August 14th, when the Harrow family went to a football practice at a local park. And the practice was supposed to be from 6 to 8 p.m. Near the end of practice, around 7:30, 7:45, Rebecca Harrow, however you want to say it, drove a short distance to the Big Five Sporting Goods store on Yucaipa Boulevard to buy a mouth guard for her son. She later told reporters that she brought 7-month-old Emmanuel with her and then, after parking, placed him on the back seat to change his diaper because she could smell it. He needed his diaper changed. So she says that when she was in the midst of, like, getting everything together to change his diaper, she heard someone say, "Hola." Then all she saw was white. She fell to the ground, and when she came to, the baby was gone. So she ran into the store, called 911. It was still light outside for Yucaipa in mid-August. Sunset is roughly like 7:30, but it's still bright enough to see what's going on in a parking lot. Now, Emmanuel was described by police as about 24 inches tall, around 21 pounds, brown eyes, brown hair. His eyes are actually cross-eyed, and he was last seen in a black Nike onesie. Now, this has not been confirmed, but all of the pictures of Emmanuel suggest that he has some sort of special needs, and there's been speculation on what those needs are, but we'll kind of get to that. Like, once you get the fuller picture, you can kind of surmise what those special needs might be. But here is a clip from one of their initial interviews with local media, and this is the interview that really kind of thrust this story into the spotlight because a lot of people found it odd.
We come to you guys asking you to help us find our son. He was abducted last night from Big Five. Somebody struck my wife while she was trying to change his diaper. And we just ask if anybody knows anything to please contact Yucaipa Police Department.
Don't hesitate, just call.
His name's Emmanuel. He's 7 months. He's 7 months old.
Have you been notified of any information yet by the authorities?
No, we have not.
They
haven't told us nothing.
They said they don't have any major updates.
Do you guys plan on doing a local search of your own?
We are at 4 o'clock here at Yucaipa.
I fell on the floor, and
And as soon as I got up, I couldn't find my son. I got him out of the car seat. And I laid him down so I could get his diapers ready. And somebody said, "Hola," and that's all I remember. And I saw white. No. And hearing sound, I fell on the floor. And as soon as I got up, I couldn't find my son. I checked all around my truck. And I ran into Big Five. And I asked the lady if she saw a baby or someone with a baby. She said no. It was a happy boy. He smiled.
Whoever took our son, please give him back.
The search for this 7-month-old baby boy continues, police and the family desperate to find out where he is.
So after that interview, a lot of people thought it was very odd that they were referring to Emmanuel in the past tense. And they also noticed that the bruise that was on Rebecca's face that was allegedly from this attack appeared to not only be days old, but they were questioning how you would get a bruise on the eye if you were attacked from behind. Regardless, after that 911 call, deputies with the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department responded just before 8 o'clock. K-9 teams from San Bernardino and Riverside counties searched the area. No child was located. Early on, investigators said that they were unable to rule out foul play. And then over the weekend, detectives served multiple search warrants, including at the family's home in Cabazon, and said that they had collected a substantial amount of surveillance video from areas of interest. Now, Rebecca told the media that there were no cameras in the Big Five parking lot. And deputies publicly stated that they had, in fact, recovered extensive surveillance from nearby businesses. But Big Five's own exterior cameras have been reported as not working. Either way, deputies say that they had video, and multiple people are saying that despite Big Five's cameras not working, other nearby businesses did have cameras that were working. And then it also came out there were some cashiers or employees from Big Five that came out and made statements saying that Rebecca and her husband had been at Big Five the week or so prior to this incident, asking if they had cameras because they were alleging that their car had been broken into. And so from people who are hearing that, you can surmise that it sounds like it was premeditated and that they were casing to see if there were any cameras in the parking lot, because then, of course, they could say, oh, well, the attack happened here, but we can't prove it because the cameras weren't working. Another discrepancy I want to point out that people have made online is that she left for this mouth guard at like 7:45, 15 minutes before practice is set to end. And a lot of people who have kids that play football have commented that the mouth guard, when you buy a mouth guard, you have to like boil it and you have to mold it to the child's mouth. And so like, why this urgent need to go to Big Five and get a mouth guard when there's only 15 minutes left of a 2-hour practice and you can't just give it to them anyway because you have to mold it to their mouth? So anyway, just all of these little things were kind of piquing people's interest and red flags started to come up. So as these inconsistencies emerged, the SBCSD reclassified the case from a reported kidnapping to a critical missing child investigation. And investigators emphasized that nobody has been ruled out, including the parents. So by Saturday the 16th, the Sheriff's Department said that Rebecca had stopped the interview after detectives confronted her with some inconsistencies in her story, and they reiterated through a statement that they couldn't rule out foul play. Rebecca was also asked to take a polygraph, which she apparently declined, saying that she wanted to get a lawyer. So the parents retained defense attorney Vincent Hughes. Now, Vincent has adamantly said that he only represents Jake and not Rebecca. But Vincent Hughes has told multiple outlets that the family is cooperating, voluntarily surrendering phones and passwords and allowing searches with cadaver dogs. He also said detectives showed them a liquor store camera angle from across the street, but law enforcement has not publicly released the footage. So there's also another creator called On the Tira, and Tira is spelled T-I-R-A. He lives in the area, and he's actually been able to obtain some of the surveillance footage from nearby. And what it shows is basically nothing that Rebecca suggested. You don't see anyone pull up and attack her. It just doesn't happen. And it's also been reported that despite the family's home having security cameras, whenever the police went to go obtain the footage from those cameras, a lot of the footage had been manually deleted. Now, this is all reported. It's not confirmed, but I'm just trying to give you guys as much information as I have found. Also worth noting, Emmanuel has an older 2-year-old sibling who was removed from the home by Child Protective Services over the weekend. And that was confirmed by the grandmother. Law enforcement confirmed the removal. So that did happen. Like I said, investigators executed search warrants at their home. They dug on the property. They seized a vehicle belonging to Jake Harrow. And authorities also acknowledged following up on reported sightings because there was one that was reported in Kern County, but it was not verified. So a number of outlets and social media posts have claimed additional details like blood detecting dogs during a search or the deleted home camera footage that I mentioned, but officials have not confirmed those specifics publicly. We do have one exception though. Multiple mainstream outlets have stated that deputies collected a large amount of surrounding surveillance video despite early statements saying that there were no cameras in that Big Five parking lot. There's also been reports of people who were at the football practice who said that they never saw baby Emmanuel. And there's also been allegations that there is a surveillance video that shows Rebecca being in the Big Five parking lot, walking around her truck several times, and then hitting herself in the face with the car door. Now, that is something that's been reported and talked about, but not confirmed by the police. And I actually don't believe that one. I think that the black eye was from a prior incident. And I believe that it was the result of a domestic violence situation. And the reason I think that is because there is a history with Jake Harrow. I was actually able to find these records myself early on, and I found that he pleaded guilty in 2023 in a case that was tied to a 2018 child cruelty incident. And that one stems from an incident when he beat this baby girl that was 10 weeks old within an inch of her life, giving her lifelong traumatic injuries. She is unable, she's nearly in a vegetative state at this point, but she is blind. She has a trach tube coming out of her throat. She can't walk. She's going to have care, round the clock care for the rest of her life. And so that child was sent to live with another family and has since been adopted, I believe, by an extended family member, but is in much better hands now. That little girl also had an older brother who was adopted as well, taken out of Jake Harrow's custody and their biological mom's custody because of allegations of not only child abuse, but fetal alcohol syndrome because the mom drank while she was pregnant with both children. And even despite the fetal alcohol syndrome, the baby girl was actually fine. She was born without any complications that we knew of anyway from the fetal alcohol syndrome. The injuries that she sustained and her condition now is caused by the abuse that she suffered at Jake Harrow's hands. So we have a history of this man, quote unquote man, abusing small babies. And for whatever reason, I mean, maybe he didn't have the patience to deal with a crying baby, but regardless, beating them is obviously not the answer. However, now that we see that this is a pattern, that he has this conviction in his past, and now we have a 7-month-old baby that is missing, it's not hard to put the pieces together and, you know, assume what likely happened. Another charge on Jake's record was from 2024, and he was convicted for felon in possession of a handgun. And I think it also said something along the lines of a narcotics addict in possession of a handgun. Regardless, defense counsel stresses that there's no nexus between those cases and Emmanuel's disappearance, which, of course, the defense is going to say that. But meanwhile, extended family history, like a relative convicted of murder, has also been highlighted by tabloids, and I've covered this as well. So the details surrounding that are that Rebecca's brother, so Emmanuel's uncle, is serving a 50-year prison term for murdering his girlfriend and then staging it to look like a suicide. So Rebecca's brother, James, is currently serving a 50-year sentence because back in March of 2017, Jalen Keith, who was James' girlfriend at the time, was found in a bathtub with a single gunshot wound to her head. According to investigators, he rendered Jalen unconscious, put her in the bathtub, and then shielded himself with the shower curtain to avoid getting blood splatter on himself when he shot her. Then he told authorities that she shot herself while he was sleeping. However, friends and family noted that Jalen had been planning to leave James because he had a drinking problem, and she had actually texted her family the day before she died, saying that they'd gotten into this huge fight where James became quote-unquote psycho, screaming at her and shattering her phone, and at one point she admitted that she was fearing for her safety. Now, James's defense claimed that Jalen took her own life because she struggled with interstitial cystitis, also known as bladder pain syndrome, and in the days leading up to her death had been searching things on her phone like IC depression and IC suicide rate. However, the jury didn't buy it because her doctor actually came on the stand and testified that this was not something that was out of control. It was managed by medication, and she was living a perfectly normal life despite this condition. So the jury didn't believe it, didn't believe his story, and believed it was actually James who made those searches on her phone to further bolster his alibi, and he was convicted of murder. Now, back to Emmanuel's case. As it stands today, August 21st, today is Thursday when I'm recording this, so things are actively evolving and they could even change by the end of the day. But as of right now, the parents have not been charged. They are, however, under heavy scrutiny because many people believe that Rebecca's black eye was likely caused by Jake prior to this whole incident, and that now Rebecca's story is that she's covering for Jake and that Jake did something to this baby. As updates come out, I will be sure to update you on them. Make sure you're following me on social media at mama.mysterypodcast. That's on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook. I cross post to all of those, so anytime I have an update on this story, I will let you know. And as always, if you see anything or if you have any information regarding this case, you're urged to contact the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Dispatch at 909-387-3717 or submit tips anonymously to WeTip. Next, 43 years later, the husband of Janet Renee White finally sees justice carried out on a record-setting day for Florida executions. So Janet Renee White, who everyone called Renee, was just 24 years old in 1982. She worked as an insurance agent in Lynn Haven, Florida, a small town in Bay County near Panama City. Friends and coworkers remembered her for her warm laugh and her kind, approachable personality. She was newly married to Randy White, the love of her life since their teenage years, and their future together seemed really bright and wide open. But on June 14, 1982, Renee left work at midday, stepping into the parking lot behind her office. And that is where everything changed. Waiting outside was Cale Barrington Bates. He abducted Renee, dragged her into the nearby woods, attempted to sexually assault her, and then stabbed her to death. He ripped her wedding ring from her finger before just leaving her body behind in the woods. Police caught him close by. His shirt was stained with blood. He had a rifle with him, and he confessed immediately. So in 1983, Bates was convicted of first-degree murder, kidnapping, armed robbery, and attempted sexual battery. The jury sentenced him to death. But as with most capital cases, the conviction and sentencing were only the beginning. Over the decades that followed, Bates challenged his sentence repeatedly. In 1995, he was resentenced, but the outcome didn't change. Death row remained his reality. And his appeals raised several issues, like claims of ineffective counsel during trial, which I think is like the number one issue that death row inmates tried to protest, is that they had ineffective counsel. He also argued that prosecutors failed to test key DNA evidence. There was also allegations of flawed jury instructions, and there was a challenge to the fact that his jury was all white, despite him being a black man. Now, all of those appeals were rejected both by the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court. Alongside his direct appeals, Bates also pursued civil litigation. In 1983, he followed a lawsuit challenging Florida's death warrant process. His attorneys argued that the system was racially biased, pointing to statistics showing that 95% of death warrants signed in Florida involve white victims. And his attorney went as far as to say that Governor DeSantis has not executed a single white defendant for killing a non-white defendant. Now, despite the lawsuit drawing attention to racial disparities in Florida's youth, use of the death penalty, the court dismissed his claims. And finally, in August of this year, Governor Ron DeSantis signed Bates' death warrant. So on August 19th, Bates was moved into the execution chamber at Florida State Prison in Stark. At exactly 6 p.m., the procedure began. Bates declined having a last meal, and he gave no final statement. And by 6:17 p.m., he was pronounced dead. There's no official record of Bates' last words because he chose silence, but Renee's husband, Randy White, was present in the witness room that evening. He had lived with the weight of this case for more than 4 decades, attending hearings, reading appeal after appeal, and waiting for closure. And I want you to think about this in regards to the Brian Koberger case. A lot of people were really upset when he took that plea deal and agreed to just life in prison when he really should have been sentenced to the death penalty, especially if the case had gone to trial. This is exactly what I think everyone was trying to avoid, was the decades-long process. I mean, this guy still got to live 40 years before he was finally executed. So I guess my question to you is this, like, if this were your family, what would you rather have? Would you rather have, you know, a shut and close case where you know that he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison forever? He's never, ever, ever going to get out and there's going to be no appeals, or at least no successful appeals. Or would you rather him be sentenced to the death penalty, but know that that comes with decades of possible setbacks or possible, re-sentencing or whatever, like all of the bureaucratic bullshit that comes along with the death penalty conviction? What would you rather have if this was your family that was a victim of such a heinous crime? It's just something to think about. You can let me know in the comments section on Spotify. You can also message me privately through my website, mamamystery.com, or however you want to contact me. But Bates's execution marked Florida's 10th execution of 2025, the most executions the state has carried out in a single year since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976. In fact, Florida has now outpaced Texas, a state that is long known for its high number of executions. And it's not stopping there, because 2 more executions are already scheduled, one being Curtis Windham on August 28th, and the next is David Pittman on September 17th. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, which is Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out for more new to you styles. I will admit I was a little skeptical at first because I'm not the type of person who dresses up very often, but you guys, this is actually so perfect and I'm genuinely so excited about this new membership with Armoire. And I want to tell you what the process was like for me. I got onto their website and I mean, there were so much to choose from. I ended up choosing 6 items and I was kind of like, we'll see what happens, you know, not sure how they were going to arrive, if they were going to be like noticeably used or what. But listen, 2 days after I placed my like case order, it showed up on my doorstep. Everything was like, when I pulled it out of the bag, everything was neatly folded and then tied up in this really pretty little bow. And I got so excited. I'm actually taking a trip to Dallas with my daughter soon, so I'm gonna wear an outfit for that. Austin and I are gonna go to a Teddy Swims concert, so I got an outfit for that. I'm like, you guys, I'm so excited about this because everything showed up in great condition. I mean, I think it looks brand new. And it's $900 worth of clothes that I'm renting for less than $100. And the best part for me is that I can just send it back. I don't typically dress up that often, but this is so perfect for like the random occasions that I do dress up without having to go and like splurge on an entire new outfit that I might only wear once. I will be honest, I feel guilty that over half of my closet has only been worn once, if at all. And there are even a few items that are going to Goodwill with the tags on them. So I love being on trend and having new things to wear, but I hate the waste that I'm creating when I do that, right? So Armoire allows me to rent these high quality designer clothes for any occasion and then just send it back. If you've got a wedding or a job interview or just like anything that you just want to kind of dress up a little bit. But the nice thing is they also have athleisure. So I got this really cute Kate Spade anorak jacket that I can wear with like a pair of leggings, and it just kind of makes you feel a little more dressed up while you're still dressed down. I also got some really cool floral wide leg pants from Steve Madden with this really cute denim halter like front vest top to go with it. And just in case that doesn't work out, I got another option too to go with the pants, and then I can have like kind of two outfits in one. You guys, I cannot tell you enough how excited I am about this. And right now my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. That's up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Please try Armoire today, and if you do, tag me in the pictures of your outfits so I can get some inspiration and kind of see what y'all are getting. But this is so fun. I'm really, really excited about this. Thanks again to Armoire for sponsoring today's episode. And now back to the story.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Moving on to this next story, there were 13 years of warnings, 13 years of fear, and for Samantha Stites, it nearly ended in tragedy before the system finally admitted that it had failed her. Samantha was just a freshman at Grand Valley State University in Michigan in 2011 when she met Christopher Thomas. They crossed paths in a Christian student group. At first, he seemed harmless, friendly, maybe a little awkward. But soon his attention started to grow to an obsessive level. He started following her to class, showing up at the gym, sitting near her at events. Over time, the stalking escalated, and Thomas installed GPS trackers on Samantha's car. He also harassed her online and in person. In 2014, Samantha sought protection. She secured a 6-year protection order, which was supposed to shield her. And for a while it did, but when that order expired, Thomas came back. The cycle of stalking and harassment just resumed, and Samantha once again found herself fighting to feel safe. Then came October of 2022. Christopher abducted Samantha and her dog, forcing them into a windowless, soundproof storage unit bunker that he had built. It wasn't a makeshift hideout. It was carefully stocked with food, surveillance equipment, and restraints. It was clear that he had planned for long-term captivity. Inside that bunker, Samantha endured 14 hours of terror. At sentencing, she later described the ordeal in a victim impact statement, saying, quote, "I wondered if I would see daylight again. I shook and sobbed after he raped me. I wasn't sure he would stop," end quote. Now, incredibly, Samantha was able to keep her composure during those 14 hours. She convinced Christopher to let her go using calm words, reasoning with him, and just clinging to hope. After he released her, she immediately called the police. Christopher was arrested and charged with kidnapping, torture, aggravated stalking, and sexual assault. In 2023, he took a plea deal, pleading guilty to kidnapping, torture, and aggravated stalking. The sexual assault charges were dropped under that agreement, and he was sentenced to 40 to 60 years in prison and placed under lifetime GPS monitoring should he ever be released. Now, Samantha's case did more than just put Christopher behind bars. It changed the system itself. Because of the high-profile failures in her situation, Michigan courts reevaluated how protective orders are handled. Judges are now instructed to place greater weight on long-term stalking risks when reviewing requests for restraining orders. And the goal is to ensure that victims don't lose protection simply because time has run out on an order. Her story is now the subject of a new docuseries, Stalking Samantha, 13 Years of Terror, which began streaming on August 19th on Hulu. The 3-part series traces Christopher's obsession, the failures that left Samantha exposed, and her resilience in surviving captivity. It doesn't shy away from drawing parallels to the Netflix show You, which Christopher reportedly admired and disturbingly seemed to emulate. Today, Samantha works as a social worker. She lives with enhanced home security measures and has co-founded Beekeepers Advocacy, an organization supporting stalking survivors. She has turned her darkest experience into advocacy and systemic reform, ensuring that others don't have to wait over a decade for the protection that they deserve. And there's another docuseries that was recently released on HBO called The Yogurt Shop Murders. So that'll be our next story. It involves four teenage girls, one frozen yogurt shop, and a case that blazed and then went cold. And now more than 30 years later, this new series is finally bringing them back into focus. So on December 6th of 1991, at an I Can't Believe It's yogurt shop in Austin, Texas, four girls lost their lives in one of the city's most haunting crimes. They were 13-year-old Amy Ayers, 17-year-old Eliza Thomas, 17-year-old Jennifer Harbison, and 15-year-old Sarah Harbison. Eliza and Jennifer were working at the shop that night, and Sarah, Jennifer's younger sister, and Amy had stopped by to catch a ride home. What happened inside is almost too brutal to process. The girls were found tied and gagged, in many cases with their own underwear. They had been stripped of clothing, shot execution style in the head, and left in the back of the shop. A fire had then been set to try and cover the crime. Amy, the youngest, was found slightly apart from the other girls, but her arm was stretched out towards the group as if she was reaching for them. Now, at first, investigators suspected organized criminal involvement, but the trail quickly grew complicated. Two teenage boys, Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott, eventually confessed, but the way those confessions were handled unraveled the case. Each boy's statement was used at the other's trial, violating their rights under the Confrontation Clause. Their convictions in the 90s were later overturned, and when DNA testing advanced, the evidence didn't match either of them. So by 2009, both men were released. Then in 2022, investigators announced that they had detected DNA from an unknown male on evidence and applied YSTR testing, a technique previously used in the Boston Strangler case. The FBI, however, would not release possible identities due to donor anonymity policies. Even so, Austin detectives have said that they remain hopeful that one day the source of that DNA could finally unlock the case. So now the story is being re-examined in a new four-part documentary titled The Yogurt Shop Murders, and it's directed by Margaret Brown and produced by A24, with executive producers including Emma Stone. Now, A24 has been known to kind of over-sensualize and, like, over-dramatize people's stories. So the Menendez brothers, Monsters, I think was the documentary, or the, not documentary, but the scripted series that was supposed to detail their lives, right? Which, speaking of, the Menendez brothers have their parole hearing today and tomorrow. So I will absolutely hop on to update with a short episode when that comes out. But anyway, back to this. So the series premiered at South by Southwest in March before launching on August 3rd on HBO and Max. And it features interviews with victims' families, investigators like John Jones and Mike Huckabee, journalists, memory experts, and even the men that were once imprisoned for this crime. So the director originally planned a stylized, almost Lynchian approach, but after meeting with the families, she shifted tone completely. So the final series is really grief-driven and respectful, focused on justice and memory rather than sensationalism. And A24 even funded therapy for the production team, knowing and acknowledging just how heavy the material was. So this documentary is not just meant to be a retelling. It's really meant to be a reawakening. By bringing this story back to the surface with compassion and rigor, it gives these girls and their families a renewed voice. And it ties into real change because in 2022, Congress passed the Homicide Victims Families Rights Act, which allows cold case reviews on a federal level. So the act was partly motivated by cases like the yogurt shop murders, where families have waited decades without answers. For Austin and the families and for cold case advocates across the country, the hope is that renewed attention could hopefully spark some new leads, or at the very least, ensure that Amy, Eliza, Jennifer, and Sarah are never forgotten. Now, our last story is about a case that's still kind of ongoing, so I'll probably be updating this once the trial starts, but it's regarding Sarah Grace Patrick. So in February of 2025, tragedy struck in Carroll County, Georgia, when Kristen Brock, who was 41 years old, and her husband James Brock, who was 45, were found shot to death in their own bed. The shots were fired while they slept, and their youngest child, who was just 6 years old at the time, was the one who discovered them and alerted her older sister. That sister was 16-year-old Sarah Grace Patrick, who lived in the house at that time. She called 911 to report the murders, and in the weeks and months that followed, Sarah Grace posted grief-stricken videos and messages on TikTok. She posted videos of her giving a eulogy at the parents' funeral, and she reached out to true crime creators, including one called Allegedly Reportedly, asking them to cover the story and hinting that she had intel that could make it a really big hit. That was from Sarah Grace. Sarah reached out and said she had intel that could make this a really big hit. So after a months-long investigation by the Carroll County Sheriff's Office, the GBI, and the FBI, Sarah Grace turned herself in on July 8th. She was charged as an adult with 2 counts of murder and 2 counts of aggravated assault. Despite no criminal record and no history of running from the law, prosecutors said they had significant concerns. And the state emphasized that her 6-year-old sister, who remains a key witness, could be vulnerable if Sarah Grace were released. So a couple days ago, on August 19th, she appeared in court for her bond hearing, and supporters sat in the courtroom wearing shirts that read, "I stand with Sarah." She entered smiling and hugging her attorneys, but later broke down in tears when her caregiver, Caitlin O'Keefe, spoke about memories of Kristen Brock, who was Sarah's mother. Prosecutors told the judge that they had mountains of digital footprint evidence pointing to Sarah Grace's TikTok posts, her outreach to influencers, and her online messages about wanting coverage of the case. The defense, meanwhile, has stressed her age, her lack of prior record, and the fact that there is no physical evidence directly tying her to the murders. Judge Hightower sided with the prosecution, calling the case too serious to let her go, so her bond was denied. After the hearing, a family friend told reporters, quote, "We are very thankful the court recognized the seriousness of this case. Bond denial was appropriate." However, Sarah Grace's grandfather pushed back, saying that there's no physical evidence linking her to the crime. So it sounds like people, not even just people hearing the case, but her own family is divided on this case. So with bond denied, Sarah Grace remains in the Carroll County Jail, one of the youngest inmates there at only 17 years old. Her arraignment is scheduled for September 22nd, and her potential trial start date is January 5th, although that's obviously fluid and likely to change. Until then, prosecutors will continue building their case around Sarah Grace's digital activity, while the defense leans heavily on her youth and the absence of forensic proof. But the case is not just about allegations. It's about how grief, trauma, and a teenager's online presence became part of the evidence. Social media posts that once looked like mourning are now under a microscope in a courtroom. And with the judge refusing bond, the community is left watching how the justice system balances youth and technology and tragedy, all while a 6-year-old girl carries the weight of being the case's key witness. So I'll be interested in seeing how this plays out, and hopefully we can get some answers, because if she did do this, I mean, she turned herself in, but if she did do this, why? Why on earth did this girl allegedly murder her parents? Hopefully those answers come out at the trial. So I will keep an eye on it and update you as the case progresses. Until then, make sure you're following me on social media, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook. I cross post on all of it. And make sure you're following Mama Mystery, the podcast in general. It costs you nothing to follow the podcast, but it will give you updates or notifications when we have new episodes so you don't miss a story. That is it for today's weekly docket. I hope you all have a great weekend. I'll be eager to see how the Menendez parole hearings shake out. So I'll be back to update you that with that, likely in like a 5-minute episode. So anyway, have a great weekend. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
Lowe's has the Labor Day deals you need to give your home a new look. Buy one, get one free select interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Then, add the final touch with two for $8 on select 2.5 or 3-quart mums. Refresh your home and save big while doing it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 9/3. Mums offer in-store only. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for details.